when I was at the University of Massachusetts, the head of the comparative literature department used to say the only thorough explanation for anything is a complete explanation of everything else. And I think it's true when all is said and done. This is the whole, you know, this is the context argument that controls a lot of, you know, something like Derrida's Limited Ink, his whole approach to, you know, to the Austen performative problem. You can't get rid of that problem. That whole 19th century notion that you can cut off everything extraneous and you can find the essential. By the time you've cut off enough extraneous things, you've cut off the thing itself you're examining. This is why all sorts of logical moves are fundamentally reductive. And Louis has had the character in my story has had one of those epiphanic realizations of this. And heck, I originate every voice, man. I'm always turning and going and growing and turning into something else. You know, I read a book yesterday and I say, hey, that's a really neat idea. That becomes the origin of who I am today. One of the origins of who I am today. And why should one privilege my great, 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 great grandfather? Why not his wife? Why not any one of the entire tree? You know, we all know that there's an entire tree that goes into creating this. And not only is that tree genetic, it is also ideological, it's ideational, it's affective, it's cultural, social, biopolitical. All of these things go into this. And Louis just had a momentary blast of, you know, realizing the interconnectedness of everything. And so he's there in the field. He's expostulating for it.
You seem to treat in very similar ways identity. So in some ways you have no particular use for it, for the concept. In pragmatic terms, you'll defend it.
No.
It's very much like Gayatri Spivak, for example. Are you moving towards some notion of hybridity or shifting identity or just the kind of cultural notion that applies, very pragmatic notion that applies to particular local situations?
I think identity, it's a provisional notion. Like race, it doesn't exist. The problem with identity is simply that there isn't any such thing. Or another way of saying the same thing, I mean, it has no ontological status. It has a provisional status that allows language to, you know, I mean, you can't have language without categories. I think identity is a synonym for category. And categories are arbitrary. I mean, that was one of the Saussurean realization that the sign is arbitrary. And not only is the sign arbitrary in what it can be assigned to, the range of things that you can assign the sign to. There's nothing to stop me from saying that apples are all these little red things on the tree, and there's also the little green things, and it's a computer. Well, there's nothing, no relationship between Apple computers and Apple trees, but they're all apples. The sign really is arbitrary. And the categories that we create from the sign are also arbitrary. And because they're arbitrary, when they serve functions, they allow language to proceed in an efficient manner. When the categories are not useful, language snarls and people argue over, and then the next thing you knew, we come up with a new category that's more efficient and allows less snarling. And it is an entirely provisional process. Never is it a matter of finding some inner essence of appleness that both computers and red and green, you know, and crab apples and Macintoshes share. And the fact is, you know, if you want to make distinctions, there could be distinctions made between two Macintosh apples, you know, why they should be belong in different categories if that's what you're talking about. If what you need to talk about is apples that have their full complement of 16 seeds and some that are deficient and only have 13 or 12 seeds, and those are the two categories you need, so you come up with a blah and a blah. You then use that to distinguish between them, and that if you need to make those distinctions, that becomes an efficient way of talking if the larger context is such where those distinctions are necessary, operative, and useful to make. It's nominalism. It's Foucauldian nominalism.
The strategy that we were talking about, the word queer that's often used now sort of collectively, and then these sort of multiply dividing letters in the LGBT. That seems like two separate strategies. One that queer is sort of getting to this place of an umbrella, mm-hmm. and the other is sort of the dissection. And mm-hmm. it seems like perhaps there's this third strategy that language or categories or identities can be used to point back to identitylessness.
identitylessness is categorylessness, and as long, you know, and as soon as something is perceived, it is immediately has its category. If nothing else, it is in the category of that which has been perceived. Up until that time, I haven't perceived it, then it is in the category of that which I did not perceive, you know, before a certain time. In the same way that, you know, there is no genreless text, there is no categoryless thing. When somebody like Derrida says the world is constituted by language, that's what he means. You know, that to perceive it is immediately to potentially linguify it.
I'm still intrigued by this question whether there is a counter process to this process of appropriation, linguistic appropriation by the dominant culture of various lingos and concepts coming from subcultures or alternative cultures. But I'm interested if there's a process of reclaiming some of these concepts and words. I mean, thinking, for example, of Skip Gacy's book on the signifying monkey and how a subculture can reclaim the terms of the dominant culture. Do you see anything like that happening in the kinds of cultures that you have moved around?
Okay, well, the problem there for me is the notion of dominant and undominant culture. I think to talk about a dominant culture is immediately to get yourself to be complicit in a certain illusory situation. I don't think today there is any dominant culture. I think there are lots and lots of intersecting marginal cultures, and one or two of them call themselves dominant, or people have taken to calling them dominant. I don't think the straight white male is any more dominant now at this point than anybody else, you know, because the straight white male, it divides up into too many, you know, there are overweight straight white males, and there are underweight straight white males, and there are ones who are too old and too young and too fat and too thin. Sure, it is useful to put them sometimes it is useful to put them into a category. Sometimes it's even politically useful to put them into a category. But again, if you're going to deal with it at a sophisticated level, you're going to have to break things up into much smaller groups. Granularity is all. Like ripeness is all. Sometimes you can increase the granularity so that to the point where you can't see larger patterns, at which point then your granularity is getting in your way. Having said that, I think terms are constantly circulating. I don't think they're ever static. They're always moving around and shifting, if nothing else, like Brownian motion. And at certain times, there are certainly routes in which some of that circulation occurs. The media being a prime example, those kinds of circulations would be much more promoted by media of the sort like the Village Voice or the Gay Press or things like that than the New York Times. Although, you know, circulations occur even in, you know, the National Enquirer and the Sun. Whenever the communication is going on, you've got signs are circulated. Not so long ago, I was a part of a symposium, a new literary history. There were these bunch of questions, and eight questions, and about 50 writers all were sent given. And one of them was, is there any group that you feel that you are politically allied to? You know, my answer was, you know, of course. What are you asking? Are you asking, am I interested in black people because I'm black? Interested in people with beards because I have a beard? With people who are overweight because I'm overweight? Interested in males because I'm male? Or gay people because I'm gay? You know, or people who were born Episcopalian and eventually became atheist because I was a born Episcopalian, became an atheist. The answer to all of these is yes and so what? Everybody is interested in the groups that they, you know, in the categories they belong to. How could you not be? All you're asking is, am I a human being? But what the question implies, and this is the thing that it's so hard to articulate, the question implies that there are these groups, and we all know what those groups are. They are gays, they are women, they are blacks, they are Jews, you know, and that's it. And that there is this place from which one can answer that question either yes or no. If you belong to a certain unmarked group, then you can say, no, I am not interested in all these groups, but, you know. Well, this is absurd. Of course you're interested in the groups that you belong to. I assume white people are interested in white people because they're white. Why the hell should they not be? It's absurd not to be. Everybody's got problems. I may even think my problems are more severe than your problems. You may think my problems are more severe, but you can do something about yours where you can't do anything about mine. There's a whole range of responses to these things. Again, that if you start looking at the thing with a finer granularity, the question begins to dissolve. And I suppose I'm still trying to dissolve some of the tensions between those that set that question in a place that can be that it can be answered yes or no, and the tension between the yes or no, the opposition between that yes or no, has to be somehow deconstructed.
Your assumption again is the sort of Foucauldian assumption that we are sort of equal on a grid, mm-hmm. that allows all these options.
Yes.
In that sense, for me, for example, the concept of hegemony still applies, mm-hmm. to some extent.
Yeah, so
I'm still thinking that the culture still has certain dominant patterns.
Absolutely,
And that there is, if not the kind of polarization we had during the Cold War with culture and counterculture, there is still some kind of tension there between them. So from that perspective, I think the question in some ways is legitimate, because wherever we are, in whatever group we are continually reappropriated by some larger concept.
The problem is hegemony of an element of one's political ontogeny, or is it a political effect? And I think it's a political effect, not an ontological absolute.
Right. Well, you mentioned the National Enquirer, so I thought I'd ask a tabloid-esque question.
Sure, please do.
I think more than anyone I know, your private life, and more specifically your sexual life, is sort of accessible to the public. And
something of an illusion. Okay. Just to say there's a vast amount of my private life. That really is private.
And this is not only sort of out there, like Bill Clinton's private life, but by choice to some degree. And I'm curious whether there has been sort of unimagined consequences or unanticipated consequences to this, and whether it's actually shaped your identity by having that.
By and large, there haven't been, and that's why I've been comfortable doing it. As I was talking a couple of years ago, I was talking to a class at Bryn Mawr, and they had just read Times Square Red, Times Square Blue, and they'd also read Bread and Wine, the graphic novel I wrote about my current partner 14 years. One of the young women in the class said, well, how can you write things like that about yourself? I mean, you know. I said, well, you know, is my dignity compromised in any way by saying in a public that I do things that everybody else does, that I go to the bathroom, that I have sex, you know, and that I have sex in a particular way? I don't see what this has anything to do with my dignity, you know, in one way. My dignity is inviolate. Catch me out in certain lies, some of which I've probably had to tell, you know, and I might get a little red in the face. But I'm not going to get red in the face because, oh my God, he's got a penis. So how does that make me different from anybody else, either at the table or any place else? There's something highly artificial about claiming a sense of dignity because we don't mention things that are relatively universal. That's kind of the way I justify it. And I think because they are relatively universal, and because people feel that they would look rather stupid saying, you know, oh my God, but you said you've got a penis, so therefore, you know, something's really wrong with you. That begins to just crumble as soon as it's articulated.
But what is unique is the willingness to risk that.
I think when all is said and done, it's a non-risk. And in terms of practical response, I'm really trying to think of some place where that has had some repercussions that are even notable, much less interesting. I can't think of too many.
Do you want to plug your new books, your various new books?
Actually, I don't like plugging new books on tape, but I will tell you about them anyway, because I'm sure my publicist would prefer that I did. In the spring, Vintage Books is bringing back into print The Fall of the Towers, an early trilogy of novels, all in one volume. And they've been doing a nice job releasing some of the early science fiction as well. A new novella, short novel, is coming out from Bamberger Books called Phallos. Then there is a collection of essays, writings, coming out from Wesleyan University Press, 7 essays, 4 letters, and 3 interviews about writing. About writing is the title of the book, and the other is the subtitle, but the subtitle becomes before the title, which I thought was just kind of fun. And then the University of Minnesota Press is bringing back into print my autobiography, The Motion of Light and Water, and they're all coming out sometime between the spring and the summer.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you. Appreciate it. Thank you.